This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Scientists announced an amazing feat this week. They've recreated the extremely deadly 1918 Spanish flu virus. They obtained tissue samples from people who died of the flu and, in a feat of biochemistry, completed the gene sequence of the virus. And with that information, they were able to reconstruct the virus and found out something very interesting. It turns out that that 1918 virus was a bird virus that jumped into people and then became very, very virulent and very deadly. It's estimated to have killed 50 million people worldwide. Scientists and even the government's own health officials have been saying for months that if the avian flu currently in Southeast Asia mutates into a form that can be passed from person to person, like this 1918 virus, we could be facing a pandemic the likes of which we haven't seen since 1918. They've been talking about this for months and have not been getting much attention here in this country, but just this week, President Bush finally addressed the avian flu threat in a press conference. He brought it to the front burner, questioning whether the U.S. is prepared to handle a pandemic. He even talked about calling in the military should a quarantine be necessary. Well, the avian flu is certainly a serious threat, but the more immediate threat is this year's influenza season that is starting. The flu season kicks in this month. Are health officials predicting tough times ahead? Who are they recommending to get vaccinated this year? Is there enough flu vaccine to go around? This hour, we'll be talking about the 1918 virus and what it tells us about current flu threats, from the annual flu virus to the avian flu in Asia. We'll also talk about what's in store for us this year in the U.S. in the flu season. If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. William Schaffner is a professor and the chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University. And that's in Nashville, Tennessee. He joins us today by phone from San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Dr. Schaffner.
Hello, Ira. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Jeffrey Taubenberger is the chair of the Department of Molecular Pathology at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington. He joins us from his office. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Christopher Bassler is an assistant professor of microbiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. He joins us today. Welcome to the program, Dr. Bassler.
Thank you.
Dr. Taubenberger, let me ask you first. Your research team has completed the gene sequence of the 1918 virus. That was a long time in coming, wasn't it? How long were you working on that?
It's a 10-year project, actually, that's just brought to its conclusion now. We started the project in 1995, and it's taken such a long time because the RNA fragments or the genetic material of the flu virus in 1918 had to be fished out one little tiny fragment at a time from autopsy tissues of people who died back in 1918. So it's been a very, very slow process.
So you had to go find those tissue samples first.
Right. So we found tissue samples that still had little fragments of the genetic material of the virus preserved in them from two different sources. One were from people who died of the flu and then whose tissues were saved at time of autopsy. Mm-hmm. And then another source of tissue from a body of somebody who died of the flu in 1918 but who was buried in the permafrost in Alaska. And in an exhumation in 1997, some frozen lung tissue was obtained by my colleague Johan Hulten. And so together, using all of these materials, we were able to slowly piece together the entire sequence of the virus.
And now you've published the entire gene sequence of the virus.
That's right. We've been publishing parts of it all along over this last 10-year period, but this week we published the remaining three gene segments, which actually, out of eight, but it actually ends up being a huge part of the virus. It's half of the virus's genetic code were published in this one paper.
And what were the surprises that came out of this?
Well, I think that one of the first surprises that's come out of the way we've looked at this virus is that we think that the sequences suggest to us that this was an entirely bird-like virus that adapted to humans. And the reason we think that's surprising but also really interesting is that we know something about the way that the pandemics of 1957 and 1968 formed. And they were actually mixtures in which a human virus mixed with a bird flu virus, and that human virus then acquired two or three genes from a bird flu virus. But in 1918, it really looks like that mixing didn't occur. It looked like an entirely bird-like virus ultimately got into people. And so that means that a pandemic can form in more than one way. And that means, therefore, for the future, that for an H5 virus or any other virus that has this potential, it could go down both or either of those paths.
And that's, I guess, what makes this Southeast Asian bird virus so scary.
Absolutely. You know, here's the real problem is that everybody is, of course, extremely concerned about this virus. It's a virus that is very lethal in chickens and other bird species, but also clearly quite lethal in a small number of human beings who've been directly infected. The great thing for us so far is that this virus has not acquired the ability to go efficiently from one person to another. And that's really the key. And what we hope to learn ultimately from the 1918 virus as an example of what are the rules that govern this process. How is it that a virus that's adapted to live quite happily in a duck, for example, can move and adapt to a new host like a human being? So what has to change in each one of the proteins of the virus to make this process happen? Mm-hmm. We know that this happened in 1918. Everybody on Earth practically was exposed to this virus. It was passed from one person to another very efficiently. So we know that the 1918 virus had this ability, and so therefore we hope to learn from its sequences what those key changes are.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bassler, you took the virus then, and your research, you took the sequence, and you recreated the virus.
That's right.
Was it pretty simple to do?
I mean, I think there are many labs with the technology now to do what we did. I mean, it's not a simple task in the sense that it's very laborious, requires some degree of expertise and a fair amount of funding, but it certainly, it's not an impossible feat, obviously, since we were able to do it.
And then you infected mice and human lung cells at the labs of CDC.
Right. So basically the way the process worked was we took the sequences attained by Dr. Taubenberger, and at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, we actually reconstructed the genes de novo. And then once these genes were reconstructed, they were actually transferred to the Centers for Disease Control, where our colleague, Dr. Terry Tumpe, introduced them into mammalian cells in a high biocontainment laboratory. And the result of this procedure is that the 1918 virus, or replica of the original 1918 virus, emerges from these cells so that we're able to study it. Mm-hmm. And then this was put into mice as well as chick embryos and human cultured lung cells. And we were able to show, when we compared our 1918 virus to a more contemporary, more typical human influenza virus, that there really was something very unique about the virulence of the 1918 virus.
And what was it that made it so deadly?
So at the moment, what we can say is there are at least four genes that are clearly implicated. One of them is the hemagglutinin, or HA. This is the protein that virus requires to enter cells. And then these three last gene segments, the polymerase segments that Jeff referred to a minute ago that he recently finished sequencing, we know that each of these four genes makes a contribution to the virulence of the virus, at least in mice and in these chick embryos, as well as in the human lung cell culture.
And how would that show up in a person? Why a normal, healthy, even young person would die from this virus? What is going on in the body that doesn't go on in the other flu epidemics?
Well, again, I think that this is a question that we're just beginning to ask. You know, on the one hand, you know, as Jeff said, this finishing the sequence and building this virus is the end of a very long process, but it's also just the beginning. One hypothesis we have is when we look at the growth of these viruses in mice or in the cultured human cells, that the 1918 virus seems to be growing faster and growing to higher levels. So it may be that if you have a virus that simply replicates to higher titers faster, that it's going to be more virulent.
If I could quickly add that, you know, another thing that's quite possible is that the 1918 virus and other viruses like it, like the H5 viruses, share one feature in that they might have a tendency to copy themselves or replicate in cells deep down in the lining of the lung, in the air spaces of the lung itself, which induce a much more serious pneumonia than a virus that stays up in the upper airway passages during an infection. And we think that this kind of infection lower down the lung also generates a much more robust inflammatory response. That is, your body's immune response against this virus is very strong. And while that's important to fight the viral infection, a really rapid and very strong immune response itself might actually contribute in some ways to the damage in the lung. So it could be that a virus that your body's immune response responds to extraordinarily well might actually end up being quite damaging.
Mm-hmm. Will this help you? Can you watch the Asian flu virus that's out there now and see if it goes in the direction of this 1918 virus and then know, we'd better watch out now?
That's clearly what one of the implications of this work, and we really hope in the future to be able to do that. What we hope to learn from the 1918 virus is, indeed, what exact mutations are necessary for each of the genes of the virus to allow this process of host switching. How do you go from being a bird virus to human virus? And we've already found some parallels in several of the genes of the 1918 sample to some of the H5 viruses, avian flu viruses, that are in Asia currently or have circulated in the last few years. And so it suggests to us the possibility that some of these H5 viruses are being subjected to pressures to go down that direction. And ultimately where we want to go in the future is, in a sense, have a checklist of these mutations, and that as you do surveillance for these kinds of viruses, you would sequence across them and look for those changes. And if you need, you know, a grand total of 25 or so changes to make this leap, and you find a virus that has 5 or 6 of them, then you think this is a virus that clearly has the potential to go down this path and become human adapted, whereas if it has none of them, you think it's less likely. And so it could allow you, in a sense, to triage the viruses of concern.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about viruses with Jeffrey Taubenberger and Chris Bassler. Also going to get Dr. Bill Schaffner to come on and talk about the flu season this year, what to expect, how we might be ready for it, and also we'll talk about what do we do in case there is a pandemic. If this Asian flu virus does start spreading around the world, how should we be prepared? President has talked about doing a quarantine. Will that work? How might we bring that about? So lots more to talk about. Your questions, stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the 1918 flu virus and the actual, resurrecting of it from out of the ground and out of the laboratory, now making actual recreating the virus. Also talking about the outlook for this flu season. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Schaffner, the president said this week that they're not prepared for an outbreak. The president spoke about in a press conference about what to do and said he might have to call in the military as an option for quarantining people who our population is not used to being quarantined.
Yeah, Ira, before we get into that, I'm just sitting here with my hat off in the direction of Drs. Taubenberger and Bassler and all of their colleagues. We need to pause and say what a wonderfully elegant piece of work this is. And it started with Dr. Taubenberger's colleague, Johan Hulten, who actually went into the permafrost to get some tissue from a person who had died back in 1918, and he got some of that lung tissue out, and then we were able to take that kind of romantic source and add the most contemporary molecular biological work to recreate this virus.
It is a trait story. You're absolutely right.
This is a story that can inspire high school and college students into a life of science. Now, mm-hmm. Having said that, let's think about this. A pandemic, which might originate in Southeast Asia, whence they have come in the past, would be introduced by infected people coming into the United States, perhaps not ill yet themselves, and then settling in amongst us and spreading the virus further. A whole array of activities need to go on in order to first be able to detect those events and be sure about them, and then to respond in an appropriate way depending upon the extent of the introduction and the spread. And that would involve distance surveillance, local public health officials, perhaps indeed local security personnel, physicians responding, hospitals, and the like. If we get way to a worst-case scenario, it might involve also the military. I think particularly in logistical support, distribution of supplies, helping to maintain perhaps order, although I do think local folks can handle most of that. Most of the public health people at this Infectious Disease Society meeting in San Francisco were a little skeptical that we're going to institute military-induced quarantine anywhere.
How easy would it be to make a vaccine against this virus, should it escape?
Actually, we've made a vaccine against one of the bird flu viruses already, and we have 2 million doses in kind of a storehouse, and we are initiating clinical trials in volunteers already to see how well the vaccine works, whether it might take one or two doses, how much we have to put in each dose. That will determine how much has to be manufactured. In other words, we're doing kind of a dry run already to give us a head start in the event that something more serious happens.
And if it's not that strain, if it's a different strain that happens to...
There are always what-ifs. First, it's given the manufacturers, as I say, a dry run. They have already established the process, so we would be a little bit ahead of the game. Second, there might be some cross-protection with the virus that actually is introduced. So we would still be able to provide partial protection while we work on developing a more specific vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has been talk that around the internet, around other places, and I want to discuss this with you because I don't know if it's true or not, that the fact that Tamiflu, the antiviral medicine that people are stocking up on, may not actually be very effective against that virus. Is that correct?
I don't think that that is correct, because everything that I have heard from my colleagues is that Tamiflu in the laboratory works against the current bird flu strains, and certainly it worked against the 1918 virus, as has been shown in the laboratory already. There perhaps is some confusion. The least expensive antiviral, the one that we've had for the longest time, a drug called amantadine, that bird flu virus in Southeast Asia is resistant to amantadine. Unfortunately, the Chinese Ministry of Agriculture, in order to help the Chinese poultry farmers, suggested that they put amantadine into the water that they fed the poultry. And, of course, if there's a prescription for how to create a resistant virus, that was it.
1-800, I'll bet that was. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Pete in Fredonia, New York. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. We've heard about this in the media, and my question is, I have family in Southeast Asia. My wife's native of Cambodian. And they live in the rural Cambodia. When I ask them about this, they don't have any idea. They haven't heard anything about it. So I know that their government, or they're not getting any information, and I've lived there and I know how that is there. And what do I tell them to do about it? And the same thing when I ask people around here about it, nobody really knows, unless we listen to something like this, what to do. I mean, is there any protection that people can actually do for themselves if this now...
Yeah.
Before it happens, or when it does happen, what can they do then? Thank you.
Okay, I'll let you go. Dr. Schaffner?
Sure. There are a couple of pieces to that. The first is that many countries, Thailand, Taiwan, Vietnam, have informed their populations extensively about bird flu. I think the best thing you can do if you are traveling to Southeast Asia is not get too involved with poultry. Don't go out to those poultry farms. In the United States, I think the single best thing to do is stay alert, be aware, listen to programs such as this, because if there is an introduction, and there has not been yet, let me emphasize that, you will hear about it from the CDC and from your own state and local health department personnel, and then they will put into force their own influenza pandemic preparedness plan, and depending upon the local situation, the elements of the plan will be put into place. And so listen up and stay tuned.
There has always been talk, and I think as we speak in Washington, President Bush is meeting with drug companies who are reluctant to make flu vaccines for two reasons. We've talked about this before. One being they don't make much money on it, and two, they're afraid because all vaccines have some sort of side effect that they could be sued, and then they, you know, what happens when you get giant lawsuits? You just don't go there and make the vaccine. We've had vaccine shortages over the years. But there is talk now, and there are a couple of bills in the Senate to take that liability away from the vaccine companies so that they would be encouraged to make more vaccines. Do you think this is a good idea?
Darn good idea. The Infectious Diseases Society of America has supported that and is trying to promote that in the Congress and hopes that the Congress gives that careful thought. We've done the same thing for bioterrorist agents, for which obviously there is anti-bioterrorist agent, for which there is no market, right, normally, but we need to have the manufacturers produce something, and so the government develops a relationship, and we pay for it. Something similar needs to be done for vaccines. The other thing we need, in addition to immunization program we have, is develop an adult immunization program so that year in and year out we can provide the benefits of prevention to our adult population and thereby draw manufacturers into that much larger market.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because a recent study said that 3- and 4-year-olds should be the targets of vaccination campaigns. And if they're vaccinated, aren't we going to have fewer elderly people, you know, getting the vaccines? Why we say, hey, let's get the elderly vaccinated first. What's the logic behind this?
It's as follows. Children seem to be, in the United States, the great distributors and disseminators of influenza virus. They get moderately sick themselves, occasionally seriously, but then spread it to people who are more vulnerable because they're older or immunocompromised or have underlying disease. So if we could interrupt the transmission among those children, the virus wouldn't find its way as readily to older folks. Great strategy. First of all, we have to be assured of a vaccine supply, and we've been hesitant in that regard. And then we have to think about the very difficult feasibility issues. Who would deliver the vaccine, under what circumstances, and can we pay for it? So all of those elements would have to be addressed before we could engage in such a program. But I can assure you it's been considered and is still part of the discussions in national advisory groups.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bassler, there was some alarm yesterday, and I just noticed from the chatter on the Internet, that we now have a living, breathing virus from that 1918 flu in the laboratory someplace.
Right, I understand the concern. I mean, there are a few things we can say to sort of allay those concerns. I mean, one is the issue of cross-reactivity, I think, was the word Dr. Schaffner used. So we know that the 1918 virus actually was the H1N1 type. And we also know that since 1977, H1N1 viruses have been circulating in humans. So there's some reason to think that if a 1918 virus were to appear in the human population today, that it would be less severe than what happened in 1918. And we actually had some earlier mouse experiments that would seem to support that view. On the other hand, you know, as researchers, we don't go into this disregarding public welfare. I mean, we look at this as, in the long run, as something we're doing for the benefit of the public as a whole. And so we've gone through a very elaborate process, first thinking ourselves about how do we do this safely, and then going through several levels of government review, both at the NIH as well as at the CDC. And what was decided was that we would use a particular level of biocontainment that all the biosafety experts felt was appropriate to do these experiments, so we really see these as really very safe experiments.
1-800-989-8255. Luella in Portland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, I would like to know, you're talking to a person who had pneumonia when she was 5, and I've been susceptible to all these lung infections all my life until about 10 or 11 years ago. And I heard on the radio a woman call in and advise a talk show host who was having a hard time talking what to do about it. She was a nurse somewhere on the West Coast here during the 1918 flu, and she said that she fed her patients, and she didn't lose any patients. She took iodine, put one drop, of course, this is that real strong iodine, in a glass of water and told them to take one swallow and gargle and then swallow it and do it about every hour or 2 hours. And since I heard that, me, who has had weak lungs all my life, I've been doing it every time I get the stinging feeling on my tonsils, the beginnings of a cold, and I haven't had a cold since. So why can't they use iodine?
Dr. Schaffner, can you? That woman, how long ago, ma'am, did you hear that? She must be over 100 by now.
Well, Ms. Luella, bless you and good luck. I have no information that the home remedy that you suggest really works for anyone else other than you. But I would add, you ought to get your annual influenza immunization. You know, it's recommended for everyone who's 50 and over, anyone who's younger than that who has heart disease or lung disease, all children now 6 to 23 months of age, and all their caregivers and anyone who has contact with them, all women who will be pregnant during the influenza season, and of course, all we healthcare workers should get our flu vaccine so we don't spread it to our patients. And we're starting to immunize now, whether by injection or nasal spray. So make your appointment with your healthcare provider.
Yeah, I saw my local grocery store this year is again going to be giving them out if they had it. They advertised last year and then no one could get it. They ran out of it very quickly. We're talking about the flu this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. What does it look like this flu season, Dr. Schaffner? Does it look like we're going to have a scary flu year this year?
Well, what we can predict is that influenza will be here each and every year. Some years it's a little milder, and some years it's a little more fierce. And we've stopped making those predictions about how fierce it's going to be because the flu is so fickle it does with us what it will. But there will be influenza, and that's why we should all, every autumn, make getting our influenza immunization part of our routine before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bassler, where do you go from here now that you've gotten this far?
Yeah, I mean, Jeff alluded to this earlier, but I think we really need to begin to understand in a little bit more detail, or a lot more detail, really, which of the genes will really play a major role in virulence of this virus, and really begin to understand also what makes a particular influenza virus really pathogenic. So in other words, what is it doing to the body, and how can we intervene to make things less severe?
The fact that some but not all of the genes from the 1918 Spanish flu match the Asian bird flu, does that mean that they're headed toward more genes matching?
I guess it depends how you define matching. I mean, I think when we look at the virulence of the 1918 virus that we created, what is clear is that when you put all 8 of these genes together, it's more deadly, at least in mice, than viruses with a subset of these genes. So it looks like you need, a particular constellation of genes to cause the maximally severe virus, and it remains to be seen what will happen with these avian viruses in Asia.
Mm-hmm. And how many strains are there?
In Asia?
Yeah.
Maybe Dr. Schaffner might be better able to answer.
Dr. Schaffner?
I don't know exactly how many different strains there are, but clearly the virus has mutated a little bit. It's drifted a little bit since it started in those bird populations.
Mm-hmm. And people at one point were saying that we have overblown this threat. It does not seem to be mutating as quickly as we thought it might be.
You know, that's like saying, well, the hurricane won't come. We're going to have another pandemic at some point. We acknowledge we can't tell you what schedule it's on, but you have to remain alert and you must prepare.
And I imagine that the Hurricane Katrina effect has now spilled over in Washington a bit, where people are now picking up, the president and the Congress are picking up their ears a little bit.
I think that's been a bit of a cattle prod, and that's made them get this attention. And my hat's also off to Secretary of Health and Human Services Leavitt, because that's on the top of his agenda list, and I think he has been bringing it to the attention of both the Congress and to the executive branch.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. It's very interesting, and I think we learned a lot. Jeffrey Taubenberger is chair of the Department of Molecular Pathology at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington. Bill Schaffner, professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville. Chris Bassler, assistant professor of microbiology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Thank you all for taking time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend. Thanks. We're going to take a short break, switch gears, and talk about that time of the year again. It's the Nobel Prize time, and this week we had winners in the sciences. So science correspondent Joe Palca will be here to bring us up to date and answer your questions. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.